Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Down to Brass Tacks. Yes, we're back on Tuesdays again, Tuesday edition of Down to Brass Tacks, and my name is Peter Wickham. It's good to be with you, and it's good to be with you on a Tuesday. We discuss the issues of the day. Today is the 13th day of February 2018, and I'm in the studio this morning with Mr. Dennis Johnson. He's your technical guru, slash producer, slash supporting act, slash emotional support, et cetera, et cetera. And he will be here to take you through. That will be the voice that he will answer the telephone when you call, normally in very hushed tone so that we don't have any interruption. And he will put you on to me as soon as is humanly possible. Our call number is 434-1790. Our email address, you can email me directly at peter.w.wickham@gmail.com. The WhatsApp chat, which is very popular, 266-IVOB, 266-IVOB. This morning, we are with you until 1 p.m. Or should I say this afternoon, we'll be with you until 1 p.m. We stay with you until 1 p.m., and then we give way for school sports, I believe, that will come soon thereafter. So, from time to time, I use a tale of the good, the bad, and the ugly, and it seems appropriate this morning that I can deal with the good, the bad, and the ugly. And the good, of course, over the weekend I was involved in a function, a dinner, which was to celebrate the teaching excellence and contribution of Sir Lloyd Erskine Sandiford. And I think that often when you're dealing with a politician, especially a politician of some note and often controversial, these things often get dragged into the realm of politics. But certainly the producers of the program, the exercise, myself included, we made it clear that our role on Saturday was to celebrate his contribution to education in Barbados, especially at the Barbados Community College. So a group of former students, we got together and we feted Sir Lloyd at the center that is named in his name. And the reason for doing that was, of course, so that we could say thank you. Thank you, sir, for not only your contribution to making us the people that we are, but also the contribution to education in Barbados on a wider scale. And there is no question that the Barbados Community College, probably short of the Christchurch Foundation School, is an institution that has contributed to the tertiary education in Barbados and to the building of outstanding Barbadians in a way that is second to none. The Barbados Community College has now become the center of we call applied education in Barbados, and this has taken prominence in recent times where we are looking more heavily in that direction. And I was honored and happy to have been there, and also honored and happy to have been taught by Sir Lloyd Erskine Sandiford. And I was happy that we were able to have that function, especially at a time where Sir Lloyd, although he is aging, was able to respond to the commendations, the compliments, and to say several things in the course of that evening. It was truly a splendid evening, and I want to thank all of those who were participating and making it what it was. It was something that we were happy to be part of. So that is the good. The bad, of course, is this idea of two students being stabbed in school. And I should say this against the background of the fact, and I always point out, that one of the least outstanding days in our educational history would have been the occasion where a young girl was stabbed at the Christchurch Foundation School. And I believe that was in 1981 or 1982. No, I'm lying, 1983. Where she was stabbed at the Christchurch Foundation School and subsequently died. There were no video cameras in those days. There were no phones. Indeed, phones were attached to the wall with a dial in those days, so no one could have recorded the incident or could have recorded the aftermath. But nonetheless, we had that incident, unfortunate as it was. And the point that I'm making here is that, unfortunately, this type of thing is not new. And I think that the perception, certainly as I listened to the conversation with Corey and Lisa yesterday, perception in many people's minds is that this is new, this is something which is a result of government not doing what it's supposed to do, and it is a result of several other things. I heard Arthur, misinformed as he always is, speaking to the fact that this is a reflection of a lack of morals in society and a lack of morals in schools, and it went on and on and on. And I really don't think that a lot of the people that made comments yesterday understood the nature of the problem that we are facing in schools, the nature and the extent to which this is not new, and also the extent to which the solutions that are being proposed are not necessarily always the best. I have a lot of regard for Corey, and I think his perspectives on the issue are things that we should listen to, because he's very much in touch with this generation. But I think at a broader level, I don't know that people fully understand that this is not a problem that was yesterday. It didn't develop yesterday, and it cannot be fixed yesterday. This is a problem where we are dealing with a generation of young people that lack opportunity, that lack perspective, many of whom have serious emotional and social issues, and a generation that cannot have these issues fixed immediately. So the idea of saying that the solution to the problem, as one lady said, is that you have to reintroduce corporal punishment in homes and in schools with greater vengeance is really not it. I think, as Corey quite rightly said, this is a reflection of a society that has had too much violence, where violence is a problem-solving tool. And I've said it over and over and over again. We have domestic violence. We have violence in schools. And we yet do not understand that the problem that we are having is Barbados is too violent a society. So when young people at 60 years old decide to solve their problems in the way that they see older people solving their problems, why are we surprised? And it's not going to be fixed by any biblical nonsense about sparing the rod and spoiling the child. I think that a lot of this problem has been created by that, just that problem. And I am not gonna play with the issue in the way that others may have yesterday, because you know where I stand on religion. But the fact of the matter is that I think that this Bible nonsense is largely responsible for a lot of this foolishness that we are having today, where people seem to feel that this idea of exercising force over someone is something virtuous. It's not virtuous. And it is the seat of a number of the problems that we have. And I really do feel that we need to start thinking of it in that way. We need to create opportunities for young people. We need to deal with serious problems, learning difficulties, and so on. We have to deal with a system that alienates people who do not pass for 4 or 5 schools. And when we start to deal with these problems, then maybe we will get to the stage where young people understand things that they don't seem to understand now. So that's the bad. The ugly, of course, is the situation with our foreign reserves and with our economic situation. And it's becoming tired and it's becoming old. You know, I did not listen to Minister Sinclair yesterday. I did not listen to, I think he spoke for 5 hours, and I certainly wasn't going to subject myself to that 5-hour tirade, largely because I understand that you're dealing with a parliament that has 3 more weeks to go. We're dealing with an administration that is all but irrelevant as it pertains to solving the critical problems of the day. We're dealing with an administration that came in 2008, that was refreshed in 2013, that indicated that its number one objective was to deal first with the cost of living, and then secondly in 2013 with an economic situation that was looming. And an administration that has demonstrated, by virtue of the fact that we are here at the 11th hour talking about plans, that it has failed in terms of dealing with the major issues that are on the table. So we're going to spend several hours discussing estimates that relate to an economic situation which we don't really understand is gloomy. And now we're hearing the situation with foreign reserves. The governor of the central bank spoke, when he last spoke to foreign reserves at the end of, I believe it was the calendar year of 2018, right? I am now hearing this morning a statement that was presented in the Nation where the leader of the opposition is telling us that the foreign reserves in Barbados are now down to something like 400 million, 480, 3 to 4 weeks of import cover. She's also saying that of interest is the fact that the sinking fund of $310 million, which is the equivalent of 177 million SDRs. If you were to take that away from what is supposed to be there, we are basically left with a foreign reserve situation that is equivalent to that which took us to the International Monetary Fund in the 1990s. But the problem is that we're not hearing any talk about a plan to rescue the situation. I can only assume that Minister Sinclair plans to rescue the situation by doing a couple of things. One, he indicated that the central bank was going to be going to borrow money to top up reserves. he then indicates that they're still trying to see if they can sell the Hilton and sell the Barbados National Oil Company. So I'm assuming that that is part of the plan to top up reserves. But I keep asking the question, I mean, when you go to somebody with no foreign reserves and you say to them, I want to negotiate a loan, but you can only ask that person to be doing fiscal and economic violence to you because you have nothing. And I'm trying to understand what was the logic of us not dealing with this issue frontally in 2013. But yet still now, we are being asked to entertain a conversation on estimates that relate to an economic picture going forward and a plan, another plan, I think it's the sixth or seventh plan, or eighth, to deal with the problem that you diagnosed in 2013 and you said that you were going to deal with in that period. And then immediately after all of that, I'm supposed to give you a refresh mandate to come back into government. I just find that you're laughing at me and you're making mock sport. And I'm particularly troubled by the 8 questions that have been asked by the opposition. And I am particularly curious in knowing if the government plans to answer these questions. What is the true state of our foreign reserves? How much money do we have in foreign reserve cover? If you take out money which has been set aside for your debt payments, right? I'm anxious to know whether or not the payments in relation to the prison were made and what payments, major payments coming up do we have for the rest of the year? And where would that all leave us when those payments are made? These are the kinds of questions that I want answered. And my thing is that against this background, what's going on over the next week is a charade. You know, we discussing estimates and pretending that all is well. And then thereafter, Parliament dissolves. And one presumes that the Prime Minister will continue business as usual until whenever he decides to call election in May or June. It's frightening. Down to brass tacks, 434-1790. You can email us at peter.w.wakeham@gmail.com. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll begin taking calls on the program. Welcome back to Down to Brass Tacks, 434-1790. Good morning. Yes, good morning and welcome. How are you? And welcome to the program. Good morning. Okay, let's try another caller. Good morning and welcome. You're on Down to Brass Tacks. Good morning.
Greetings, Peter. How are you doing?
Hey, morning, Marsha. How are you doing?
Yeah. I'm good. It's so refreshing to hear your opening comments. I think more than anybody else, the two of us, 4 years at least, have been trying to get individuals to understand and to come around to our position on the issues that we have in the educational system and the problems with the rankings that we do associated with the common entrance exam and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But those are the issues that people don't like to deal with, because those are the ones that demand that we get reflective and creative to really craft solutions to the problems that exist. Instead, what we like to do is to come at the back end of an outburst of something and institute measures which really don't solve the problem. Mm-hmm. Now, the school violence over the last couple of days has highlighted the issue of arms, I guess you could call them, in the schools. There is nothing that I saw in the picture of the arms that were taken from a school compound, which I did not see during my tenure in the teaching service, and I left teaching over 10 years ago.
How about your tenure as a student?
Pardon? No, as a teacher.
Okay, but not as a student.
Not as a student, but as a teacher, I've seen all of that, and perhaps some more alarming things as well, in sweeps and searches and that kind of thing.
You went to St. Michael's, right?
No, please. Okay. Don't do that to me. I'm a proud product of the Alexandra Secondary School.
Alexandra, that's right. Yes.
I barely passed the common entrance.
You and me both.
Right. The point that I was making is, so we are seeing the arms and we're focusing on the arms. But Peter, those sweeps also throw up illicit drugs. Mm-hmm. Those wipe downs also, you know, cause concerns in terms of other things. The fact that a child would have a school bag, and in that school bag there's no books, in that school bag there's no lunch. So you are able then to see the cross-section of issues that you're dealing with. And sometimes it's not always necessarily that the child doesn't want to have those things. When you dig deeper into the situation, you get the sense that this child is a child that needs intervention. The four or five children that are giving trouble at any one given school that you can name across the island are the same four or five children who've been given trouble from primary school. But we think that instituting metal detectors at the schools across the island is a better fix for these children than creating a sounder functioning child care board that can actually give them the kind of intervention and assistance that they need. Peter, I'm so frustrated with having these arguments. My children don't give trouble. My children don't go to school with illicit things in their bags because I actually parent my children. So why would my children who are... Pardon?
You beat them?
Although it's not a zero policy on corporal punishment, corporal punishment in this house is kind of like capital punishment. So by the time you're up to that, you've done something that's very, very serious. I won't hit my children for, you know, doing homework or for the other little things that children do. Perhaps, however, if I am checking your belongings and I find something there that doesn't belong to you, you know, maybe we would have to escalate. But then my children are teenagers. No, I would have used corporal punishment when they were in their single numbers. But both of my sons are bigger than me and taller than me. I really don't see how corporal punishment could apply to a child at 15 or 16 years old. It's either you've bent the tree by this time or you haven't bent it. Now my children and I reason and we have discussions. Corporal punishment for teenagers is, I don't understand the rationale.
No, I asked you that question because that was something that came across yesterday in many of the commentaries that, you know, the problem is that we need more corporal punishment and we need to use it more effectively to get people back to an understanding. And then the other point that I think needs also to be made is with regard to the role of religion. And it was clearing, especially when Arthur's comments that, you know, the problem is that we not enough religion. You know, we need to enforce the Bible more strenuously. We need to think. And I don't believe that kind of thing happens in your home, but yet still yours seems to be one that is absent of the kind of nonsense that we're seeing in some of these schools.
No, I would never be the one. I could never be the one to come here and put an argument in support of religion because religion didn't save my four mothers and it won't save me. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that I look to for, you know, a guide in terms of raising my children and that kind of thing. But what I do teach my children is, you know, the love, the values, respect, understanding, how to be able to say how they feel if they're upset. You know, if they need to have an issue addressed, how to do that and those kinds of things. Now, religion didn't teach us any of that because I think all of us grew up in the church and around the church and that kind of thing. But we still know of the children who were being molested, who, you know, were having serious social challenges that we swept under the carpet. I think the difference is that with those children that were swept under the carpet that way in our age, they didn't understand fully the wrongness of what they were going through. So their retaliation might not, you know, have been as acute as it is today. But when
you have
television,
when
you have television, when you have radio, when a child is being unfaired and knows that it is being unfaired, the level of you know, resentment and conflicted feelings, like you rightly said, the emotional fallout is a lot more severe. So I think we did not have as much knowledge as these children have today, but we can't beat it out of them. It's all around them. So what we have to do is to be able to craft a system, okay, which is going to be able to address their needs. I would feel very, very, very offended if somebody asked any one of my four children to walk through a metal detector to go to school. You're criminalizing my child in a way that it does not need to be criminalized. That's the way I feel about it. If you tell me as a parent that you want me to take on the responsibility of parenting, and I have done that, and I have produced a child who is able to follow rules and instructions and that kind of thing, Why do you feel the right way to go about dealing with the 10 or the 20 who can't do that is to make my child who can be subjected to that type of setup to go to school? I mean, this is how we've gotten ourselves in this position in this society as it is, because we always deal with the peripheral and not the actual issue.
Marsha, it puts you and I in a school where we are actually on the same side as Jones, as Minister Jones, which is
an alarming
and uncomfortable situation for some. But I think he has a very good point that, you know, it's really not about putting a metal detector in school to catch. Because the point in time when a child comes to school with a knife in their bag, I think that the horse has bolted.
Long bolted.
Right. And, you know, there are several things that can be done before that we need to start doing now. My challenge, Marsha, is that it's not going to turn around immediately. Right? It's like the economy. There's nothing that you can do now to turn things around immediately, because this problem has developed over a long period of time. But what I would like to see is some initiatives being taken to ensure that we don't have these same conversations 10 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
You know, when that girl got killed at Foundation, it wasn't because there were no metal detectors. It wasn't because, and it was ironically not even because she had bad parents. But a situation occurred where she had diminished responsibility, and she took action in a way that she thought would help solve a problem that had been created. Ironically, it was a horrible situation, right? And it led to a girl's death. And my sense is that it wasn't a reflection of the fact that all morals and standards had failed. It's a reflection of the fact that she had a peculiar problem at a peculiar time, and she sought to deal with it in a most unfortunate way. Now, my sense is that If the system had been more willing to accept this girl's challenges of a mental nature, if we were more aware of mental illness at the time, we may very well have been in a position to save someone's life. Now,
you know,
the problem we're having now is that I don't know that people understand, and I always tell people this, I have a learning disability, right? No, I think I've been able to make a reasonably decent hand of society in terms of my own contribution. And I wonder whether a child with my same disability that didn't have the kind of financial backing and support
Absolutely.
That I had, where they would be today.
But you know what the answer is to that, because we see it every day. There is a reason why we're having this issue in the primary and the secondary schools. And then by the time we get to the community colleges and the UEs that you were just talking about, this problem seems to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
It's because those ones without the backing and support that you're talking about, we're then dealing with them on the quote-unquote block.
Mm-hmm.
And in the quote-unquote Spring Garden situation where it plays out.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they're not following through to the community college and the UE to take the problem there. But at the same time, society is comfortable to do the same thing it does at the 11 plus, at 16.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you're not academic, you can't get in, you can't get in BCC, well, you go one side there and prop up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't make the problem disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Metal detectors are not going to make the problem disappear. When are we going to start to look at the social issues that we have in this country? Like you rightly said, Peter, and I think that's a good place to leave the conversation. We have individuals in this society with mental illness. Mental illness doesn't start at 22. It doesn't start at 30. It doesn't start at 40. There are some people who are dealing with mental illness from the time that they are born.
Yeah.
There are
mm-hmm.
some people, because of the situations in which they're nurtured, the home environment, end up dealing with mental issues. Now, when you don't have proper systems of diagnoses, proper systems of rehabilitation and that kind of thing, you will end up with the problems that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you have metal detectors or not, that is not going to change. And that is the reality, and that is where the discussion should start from.
All right, Marsha, I'm tempted to pull you on to the gender line, but I think that maybe we can chat about that on another occasion. Just to remind people that the National Organization of Women and yourself would be the... you're president of the National Organization of Women? Sorry, yeah, no, I'm sorry. I don't know, Marsha, I think she's either incumbent or outgoing president of the National Organization of Women. The 8th Milroy Reese Memorial Lecture on Monday the 19th, which will be the last occasion that we have to let people know, since I'm not on the radio until next week, Tuesday. So next week, Monday, we'll have the 8th Milroy Reese Memorial Lecture at the Barbados Workers Union. The question will be, women in politics, have we crossed the Rubicon yet? And the lecturer will be no less a person than your humble servant. and I'm looking forward to giving a perspective 10 years later on a speech or on a lecture that I presented on the Milroy Reese Memorial Lecture back in 2001, looking at the question of women in politics. So we're looking back to see where we are now, and I hope to perhaps offer a perspective that is slightly different to one that was offered by another political analyst recently, and one hopefully will be slightly more thought out. So that's next week, Monday, at the Barbados Workers Union. And I know that Marcia will be there and will offer her own perspective thereafter. Down to Brass Tacks, good morning.
Hello, hi, good morning, Peter.
Morning, sir, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad, man.
Good.
I would like you to stop bantering about our word political analyst, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I get tired of that, man.
I have to give credit or give Jack her jacket.
If one presents himself as a political analyst. Anyway, I ain't called to talk about that anyhow.
The important point is that the young lady of whom we speak has a job that says she is a political analyst. She has a job that identifies her as a political analyst.
She do that as a profession. She get paid for that.
So she's paid for it. So that's what she is.
She's paid for it.
Right. As you are a political analyst, then you are a political analyst.
VOD or CBC?
Not VOD.
Let me get on the more serious thing, yeah?
All right.
Listen, it's always a pleasure hearing Marcia, though. Mm-hmm. I don't always agree with Marcia, especially when Marcia...
All the gender thing.
The gender thing, right? Mm-hmm. But
that means you don't agree with me neither.
No, of course I don't really agree with you. Okay. You know, I'm a proud supporter of MISA. Okay.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Of course. Yeah. Right?
And I am definitely not.
I would like you to get back on board. Look, anyway.
Are you looking to join now?
You pardon me?
Are you looking to join now?
You're looking to join now?
Yeah.
You're going to pirate. Anyhow, Peter, look.
You know, you must come to the lecture and listen, and hopefully you can give your own perspective.
Because I honestly believe there is a role, and a big role, for women in politics.
Okay.
Right?
Agreed. At this point in time?
Yes, of course.
And what about that particular woman?
That particular woman, the woman of which we were just referring to?
No, not that one. We're talking about the woman in politics, the key woman in politics at this point in time. Yes, Mia.
Today? Mia Motley?
Yeah, that's right, Mia Motley.
Well, look, listen, you can't ask me that unfair question, though. Anybody that know Wesley know that I really is a big supporter, ever was, and still is a big supporter of Mia. Okay. Even when I was in the bosom and belly of the Democratic Party, okay, mm-hmm. You cannot say anything unless you say good. And the Alpha Starby, okay, I get in many fights out there at the Friday gathering, right? Because I support Mayor Amor, okay, and they know my position, right? And I was in the belly of the Democratic Party, okay. And I think this is my time. I got a few lashes for you this morning, though. But before I get to that, let me touch on Marcia. Look, Marcia just said that she have teenager boys.
Mm-hmm.
But Marcia look like a teenager.
Oh, actually, the years have been kind.
The years have been kind to her. Mm-hmm. And what I remember most about Marcia always had a big heart.
Mm-hmm.
Before, pickups was fashionable, because they are fashionable now, you know. Marcia used to drive a big pickup at L200.
She still drive a pickup, yeah.
Yes, you know, and just this little woman driving, pulling around that thing, you know. So
You're also aware that Marcia doesn't eat meat.
No, Marcia's very health conscious.
Right, and I think that has a lot to do with the fact that even though she's a mother of teenagers, she looks like a teenager herself.
And back in the day,
and I know you're a man that believe in your pigfoot soul, so.
Of course.
Hopefully you will take note.
But to think about it, though, enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy it. All the people now that are very forceful now on the radio calling programs that are supporting the Barbados Labour Party, all of us was very deep-seated in the Democratic Labour Party, including yourself. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, including Marcia. Anyhow.
You're saying that Marcia would have been a better pick for St. Michael Northwest?
Well, in all fairness to the young man, Mr. Rowe, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know nothing about him. And I'm still trying to learn. I'm still trying to learn and understand the Barbados Labour Party way. I think the elections for the preliminaries have been settled. and I would not really honestly like to dive into that.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. The people make the choice, and I respect that. Okay? So mm-hmm. I won't really, at this time, want to comment on that. But Marsha, time will come.
Okay.
Right? I hope it. I hope in politics, Marsha have a place.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, let me get on to this thing. When I told you, I got a few lashes from Mayor Amar. Mayor Motley is the leader of the Barbados Labour Party.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I know that she leads from the front. She's not a backseat driver. But I must, like I tell you last week, the Barbados Labour Party have the balance of power in their hands. And if the Prime Minister decides now to call, not sorry, to engage with the estimates, right? Early estimates,
mm-hmm.
and then hold the country to ransom with a three months play out.
Right.
I blame the Barbados Labour Party.
What would honestly, you prefer strategically for her
I
to do?
I honestly believe, and I said it on numerous occasions, I believe at the first sitting for this year, I believe the Barbados Labour Party should vacate the premises of the Parliament, force the government to call an election in 3 months.
You can't force them.
The worst they could have done is March. Whether they either call 12 elections or one general election. And only a madman would have called 12 elections. Mm. You agree?
If the Prime Minister takes
eternity to June, July, I blame the Barbados Labour Party.
Yeah.
Walk out.
Couple of things. One of them is that you appreciate that Mia Motley actually spoke for 30 minutes yesterday. Huh? I think it was 38 minutes.
And I agree with her.
And I mean, against the background of the fact that last year she spoke for 4 hours, I mean, it was painful, honestly. Mm-hmm. I like Mia as much as you do, but I really find that these speeches be too long. I don't want to hear Chris for 5, and I don't want to hear her for 4 or 3 or mm-hmm. 2. In this instance, I think that anything that is worth saying can be said in 30 minutes, as she did yesterday. So against the background of the fact that she's a person who likes to talk and reply and so on, she a 30-minute speech says a lot about the extent to which the regard that she holds for the exercise. Now, I personally would have preferred if it was followed by a walkout, because my thing, like you, is that I don't know that it makes sense to engage this process any further. Because if you're saying it is a circus and it is Papi show, then don't engage it. At the same time, however, there is another perspective, which I was hearing last night, that says that when you take that position, people say that you're getting ahead of yourself. So I guess maybe there's a view that can go on either side. But I am comfortable with your idea that this theatrics that we are engaging in now, this game with Parliament and people going to Parliament and so on, I think that this is a game that I have no time for or no interest in, and I think the people of Barbados are ready to vote.
Peter Wickham?
You know?
Peter?
Yeah.
David Thompson in 2007.
Shut down Parliament.
Shut down Parliament.
Right.
Owen Arthur in 2013 or 2012. Right.
But what's the difference?
The same thing.
But what's the difference? What's the difference? The difference is that you're dealing with a person like Owen Arthur who was a strategist, a person who thought politically in a way that most would. Erskine Sandiford the same way. I really don't know that you can deal with Frondell Stewart in that way, because the kinds of issues that impact on Frondell Stewart don't impact on you or me.
But Prime Minister,
listen, if I were a Prime Minister, I would not find myself in a situation where we are now past the 5-year anniversary for all intents and purposes, and we are still dealing with parliamentary business as though it was business as usual.
You're talking about the 5-year? You passed the 10-year anniversary.
Precisely.
Anniversary.
So the point is that most leaders would not find themselves in that situation. And I mean, if you look at what's happening in Grenada, if you look at what's happening in Antigua, you're dealing with leaders that are saying, look, strategically, this is ludicrous, but at the same time, Prime Minister Frondell Stewart is a different thinker. And the point I always make is that he was right before, and maybe he can be right again.
I want to say this to you, right? I don't want you to get excited with that thing that Prime Minister Stewart is right again and right before and we're right again. Because you only have to trot, you only got to trot through certain nooks and crannies. You know,
but I went through the nooks and crannies before.
Take a walk through Marhill Street.
I walked through them places before.
Take a walk through Nelson Street. You understand?
What would I be doing in Nelson Street, sir?
Pardon me?
What would I be doing in Nelson Street?
Nelson Street is a part of our city. Nelson Street is a part of our history, buddy.
I don't know. He's only going there for certain things.
That's true. That's not so. One of the sweetest pork cutters I ever had in my life was Nelson Street.
And therein lies the problem. But this is what Dennis now opening his arms and saying.
I'm walking to that one.
Pork and prostitutes. I'm interested in none of the two.
I'm walking to that one. But no. In all seriousness, right?
Yeah.
I think people have their lead pencils sharpened here.
I agree.
And I am saying to you that people is really terrible.
Beijing's are not marching anywhere. Calling a march now is a waste of time.
It's foolishness.
Beijing's are not shutting down the public service. Calling a strike now is a waste of time. I think Barbadians are at a stage where all they want to do is vote. And if you cannot get Prime Minister Ferdinand Sir to understand that, what we're going to do, we're going to go away. If it takes us until June, we will wait.
But you're missing one important thing, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, in 2013, the same Ferdinand Sir Prime Minister was the Prime Minister and Owen asked to call his bluff. You understand? He's the same man today.
Mm-hmm.
You're only a little older. So I am cautious of repeating myself, but I am saying that a clear definitive message should have sent to the government, right? And that clear definitive message should have been walk out of Parliament the first day of January, the first sitting in January.
I acknowledge your point, and as I said, I don't know. I think I agree that there is a strategy that I would have been inclined towards. Having said that, however, I hope that the strategists within the Barbados Labour Party know what they're doing. But I think I'm closer to your side than theirs, in that I feel that this thing now is we're legitimizing something that is a political circus, you know. So anyhow. Thanks a lot for calling, sir. Good chatting with you. We're going to have to go to some messages. Of course, we had to make some money, and then we come back and we deal with some worries. Welcome back to Dr. Brastacks. Regarding the question that we were asking just now, David has chimed in and said that he agrees that walking out sends the wrong message and it made no sense in these circumstances. So there's another perspective. Dr. Brastacks, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Peter.
How are you doing, sir?
We didn't expect to hear from David, though.
David? How you mean?
I only tell you that.
This ain't David Ellis.
There's a different
David. Yeah, there's a different David.
No, Peter.
Yeah.
I was waiting to call you, and I received some very, very sad news.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, it is some person with your same name. And as the public is aware of this person, his name is Peter Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Has now passed away.
Really?
Peter is a man.
I didn't know this.
Who was awarded, I think, at tune of $1 million from rural development, and he never got a cent. I am in the same predicament from the same rural development, and I never wanted to say anything pertaining to this issue because I was involved in a matter going on over 4 years. But it is heart-wrenching now to hear that Peter had to pass without seeing his satisfaction. You see how serious politics could be against human beings?
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm talking about, Peter? Peter?
Mm-hmm.
Peter?
I'm here with you, sir.
You understand how inhumane things could be?
Mm-hmm.
All of these, over almost 8 years, that man was waiting for justice. I could not get it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even feel right now to discuss anything further, but I want to say this, and I would not like to go off because you mentioned Floyd. A man of my heart. I passed by his home last year, but his wife told me he was ailing. He could not see me. I think I had just gone in for some rest.
Mm-hmm.
But Sir Lloyd and Sir Warwick Franklin are two gentlemen that supported that Democratic Labour Party. And I can give you the reason why. You remember the 94 election?
I do, quite well.
You recall that the party, the administration, removed Sir Lloyd from office?
No. As leader? No.
When the vote was cast against when the
Parliament passed the vote of no confidence. Sir Lloyd
chose. It was supported by his administration.
It was supported by members of his administration.
Right. You recall that after the election, when he went into the night, he went to put David Thompson as leader. You know, Sir Lloyd still went back. Although he was defeated by his own people, he still went back and faced his constituency and was defeated. So Warwick Franklin did the same thing. When all of these people that making noise now and managing, and all of them sort of people that managing the DSP now, when all of them to put the wings and flee, Sir Warwick and Sir Lloyd continue as DSP candidates, and they suffer a defeat which they could not, they could have saved the defeat because they didn't have to go back to the polls, but they showed the metal that they had towards the Democratic Labour Party. So that is why I keep saying to this country, when you talking about the Democratic Labour Party, differentiate the administration. This administration this morning that sits under the banner of the Democratic Labour Party is trying to make a mockery of the people of this country. And I can tell you why. You recall very well what these people said about the trade union leaders. You remember? They would new wine in old bottle and all sorts of like. And now you could hear yesterday at the estimate that the social partnership bringing a recovery plan. Where did you, you don't recover something when it lost? Could you come and tell the public that your economy is lost, so 10 years you can find it, and now you were paid to find it because you claim that you come and find an economy that was destroyed and you had to rebuild it. Yeah, you're bringing a recovery. What this recovery plan would be to do? And not only that, you know, I can show you how this party believes that these people is some, that the barbarians are foolish. You remember the St. Chris Sinclair asked Owen Seymour Arthur as an eminent person to assist a strategy pertaining to recovery of the economy? And you remember the Prime Minister said he has his own eminent group within the Parliament. You remember that?
Chris Sinclair is eminent really enough. Richard Seeley is eminent enough. Ronald Jones is eminent enough. I remember it.
All of that. And now you bring in a group outside of Parliament and put me in mind, don't laugh at this, this is a fact. An old lady husband died and he used to suffer the corn. So when the undertaker called her and they was getting ready, she went into town and bought a new pair of shoes and said when she carried it, get the undertaker, put it on his feet. When he coming home at night, it won't hurt his foot because it's a new pair of shoes. Now this party dead. Dead. And they're talking about a recovery plan. Before they tell the country what they did for the last 10 years, they have nothing to say. They're lingering and loitering. Have you been up in Broad Street and Kill Shop and shut up? And you sitting down at the door and the night, what the police were doing you? You won't be charged with loitering?
Well, you know, the problem, sir, is that there is no constitutional facility whereby we can challenge the Prime Minister's right to continue in office until something done in June. And the fact is that he has the right to do so. You may call it loitering. He calls it his time. He's using up his time. But the point of the matter is that I don't know that there's a benefit to us continuing this discussion about the fact that he has the right. He has the right. Let him go ahead. Because he will have to face the music sooner or later. 3 weeks' time, there's no more parliament. 3 months' time after that, he has to face an electorate, whether he likes it or not. So if he prefers to wait until he has to do it than to do it when he should, then he would just pay the price in that way. My sense, sir, is that his public support is diminished. And I think that his public support is diminishing as a result of these kinds of incidents. And that's something that he ought to be aware of. But if he doesn't feel it's a problem, then, you know, carry on. What say you? All right, sir, we're going to run. Let's take another call. This is Down to Brass Tacks. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning to you, Peter.
Morning, sir. How are you doing?
I'm good. What about yourself?
Good. Not too bad. Too bad.
Okay. Peter, it's strange that the last caller finished on basically the note that I wanted to...
Start on?
To zero in on. But when I zero in on this note this morning, Peter, I am appeasing to the conscience of the people who support this administration using... The 90 days, the Prime Minister uses the 90 days after 3 weeks that Parliament is dissolved. Now, Peter, Section 69 of the Constitution has spelled out very clearly the period, 90 days, it make it clear that an election should be called 90 days after the dissolution of Parliament. Section 69.
It is, Patrick.
Just about to speak, Peter.
Okay, no, I miss your voice at first. Morning, how are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah. Right. So the point I want to make, Peter, mm-hmm. the point I want to make this morning, you did the A-level law, so you would understand mm-hmm. what I'm speaking of. The point I want to make is that what the Act is saying, that as at the dissolution of Parliament, that portfolios, the ministers holding portfolios will also be dissolved, which means that two offices will stand until an election are called. That is the office of the Prime Minister.
I heard you
office
with that.
Of the Attorney General.
Patrick, I heard you with that on your blog. I don't agree with you.
No, because the point I want to make. That's why I said appeal to the conscience of those persons who supports the Prime Minister calling the election in June. The point I want to make, Peter, is that if at the dissolution of Parliament, that the portfolios will also be dissolved, and that there will no longer be parliamentary representatives, but not ministers of the crown, right? Then someone has to explain for me the salary that will amount to just over $900,000. If you multiply $16,000 per person by 3 months,
understood?
And then you multiply the prime minister's salary that will push you just about $981,700. Taxpayers' money that will pay these salaries up until June. The point that you're making, Peter, is that if this administration has been saying to us that the country is in a recession and that the things they wanted to do as it relates to their mandate, they could not have to be done simply because that they were constrained by funds to do so, why then would you want to hold on for that further 3 months to create what we call a cost overrun in relation to salaries and wages for parliamentary secretaries and ministers of who will not be holding a portfolio under the same constitution, Section 69? Mm. Somebody must explain this for me.
Patrick, let me explain it for you. Now, the matter is that if you have...